Welcome, members and guests, to the July 31st program of the City Club of Eugene, forecasting the future of independent film. Thank you for joining us. I'm James Baldock, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Oregon Country Fair, July 8th, 9th, and 10th, 2016, Eugene Legal, Small Firm, Big Results, and KRVM. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the podcasts on their site. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year, and today is our 45th and final program in our 2014-2015 programming year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. Welcome to our newest members, Mark Gissinger, and to Cornerstone Community Housing. Today's program, Forecasting the Future of Independent Film, is coordinated by Randy Prince, who will be introducing the program now.
Thanks, James. Today here at the City Club, we're going to, this is our final summer program, we're going to consider the evolution of the motion picture industry. You know, about a century ago, telling stories with film and the experience of sitting in a big room with hundreds of other people watching these stories became an important part of our shared cultural experience. Cinema became very influential in shaping values and aspirations, the things we admire and buy, the government policies we accept, sometimes even the political leaders we choose. And the industry that produced these movies made lots of money. Hollywood's wealth even helped build Los Angeles. Well, broadcast television, cable television, and now streaming video on the internet, these mediums didn't kill off the movie. But there have been big changes in what's out there and where you might see it. Theaters with big screens still make lots of money. There are lots of offerings. But for some people, it's almost like the problem with cable television. 100 channels, nothing to watch. For most, in our City Club and our public radio audience, you'll probably find the more intellectually stimulating material at very small art house theaters, on a special cable channel, or on a disc that arrives in the mail, or maybe directly through the internet. A lot of this material is what's called independent film. Independent of the control over content by the big studios that keep financial issues front and center. And these are also the studios that have a lot of control over which movies are actually made available to the big theater chains and the more easily accessible mediums. And yet the independent sector of the film industry seems to thrive. Ever more film festivals scheduled to help these low-budget productions get attention and distribution arrangements. The Oscar nominations for Best Picture this year were heavily slanted to small films. Only one of them, a war movie by Clint Eastwood, was playing everywhere and making big money. Some said the Academy had lost touch with the audience, had become elitist, but there must be some reason why they voted this way. We have three speakers today to help us understand if this was just a blip or if there is a bigger future ahead for independent films. It affects what motion pictures we will be able to enjoy and through what medium, but also the opportunities available for creative people to work locally. Independent filmmaking might mean more movies made out of Los Angeles. Oregon's one of those places to make movies. Our three speakers here, Richard Herskowitz is a nationally recognized festival administrator and programmer who served as director of the Virginia Film Festival and the Cornell Cinema Program, currently serves as artistic director of the Houston Cinema Arts Festival and the Cinema Pacific Film Festival here in Eugene, where he's an instructor of arts and administration at the University of Oregon. Cinema Pacific, something I've always marked my calendar for in the spring, but it's now going to become more of a year-round program of events. That's a new development. In the middle, Joshua Purvis is executive director for the Eugene Film Society, an organization that supports our local community of professional and aspiring filmmakers and promotes film literacy and education. He's a photographer and filmmaker himself, and for his day job, he manages events and promotions for the Bijou Theater. And Edward Schissel is owner and operator of the Bijou Art Cinemas here in Eugene. He's a programmer for 6 screens and 2 smaller theaters. He has to navigate the difficult landscape of film distribution contracts that favors the big players in the industry and the multiplex chains that generate so much of the revenue. So Richard is our lead-off speaker to tell us what is an independent film.
Okay, thank you, Randy. I was asked to speak about what independent film is, why it's important, why festivals and Cinema Pacific are important, and I have about 8 minutes, so please excuse me if I speak fast. So what is independent film? It's simply media practice that is independent of mainstream film. So let me break that down. It's economically independent of the Hollywood studios, or what's sometimes called the majors, like Sony or Fox or Universal, those companies that produce blockbusters, sequels, etc., and they occupy about 99% of theaters around the country. So, for example, when you see at Regal and Gateway the same dozen films playing in both places, that's true about most of the theaters around the country that are showing mainstream blockbuster features. Whereas, again, economically independent films are independently financed. They run on lower budgets. They're not beholden to studios. In addition to economically independent, they're culturally independent. They generally represent the voices of people who feel disempowered or stereotyped by mainstream media. Gays, women, blacks, Latinos, Native Americans. Frequently you'll hear from a filmmaker like Spike Lee that he was tired of seeing himself not represented on screen, and he had to make films independently to have black voices heard. The same thing with women. The underrepresentation of women in Hollywood is somewhat countered by their greater representation in the independent film movement. Artistically independent is the third thing, in addition to economically and culturally. Independent filmmakers generally have final cut. Their own personal visions are ultimately dominant here. It's not taken away from them. Test screenings don't determine the final film that come out, for example. Artistically independent also in the sense that independent films tend to be more innovative, experimental. They use the full expressive range of the cinematic medium, making films that are more painterly, poetic, discontinuous, non-narrative sometimes. Or if they're narrative, they might be, in the words of Jean-Luc Godard, who said that he makes narrative films with a beginning and middle and an end, but not necessarily in that order. Okay, why is independent film important? Well, I may have a grandiose vision about this, so... But I believe that independent film is absolutely vital to our culture and democracy. Making sure that minority voices are heard. You know, film is what Roger Ebert called, I love this quote, an empathy machine. It helps us experience the world from remote points of view, understanding life experiences and perspectives, and helping us get into those points of view and understanding the world from other perspectives beside our own. Whereas mainstream films generally typically convey the point of view of white male heroes putting down threatening others. Again, this is, I think generally the independent film is much more about representing and helping people empathize with alternative ways of living in the world and seeing the world. Also, it's extremely important in that it is advancing film as an art form. The innovations that come out of the independent film community actually benefit Hollywood in the long term because they do ultimately work, many of them do work their way to the mainstream. They're kind of a laboratory, and they help advance American filmmaking. For example, Quentin Tarantino, who was influenced by Hong Kong films and by other films, and then brought those innovations to American film. And now when you see, you know, Mission Impossible or other big budget films, a lot of what he helped introduce to American filmmaking has made its way to the mainstream, and independent filmmakers are moving on and creating other innovations. And these films challenge viewers, respect their intelligence. Again, very important to our culture. Why film festivals are important? Well, film festivals, just like film societies, like the Eugene Film Society, and art theaters like the Bijou, are all part of what I see as the larger independent film movement, trying to create an ecosystem to support independent, non-mainstream filmmaking. Now, we're all struggling because we're usually non-commercial, non-profit. We don't show sequels, or we don't rely on porn or whatever else sells the most, and also public funding has declined dramatically in this country and used to help support more of the ecosystem of independent film. Film festivals gather together a lot of independent films in a concentrated period, and they add music and food and interactivity with filmmakers. There's aliveness to the festival experience that distinguishes it from the mainstream film-going experience. And because of that concentrated programming and festivity, festivals have a shot at getting the media and public attention that can stand up to the promotional tsunami of Jurassic World or these other blockbusters that dominate our consciousness through relentless promotion. That's why I think festivals have become so successful. Okay, they create a counter market. Why Cinema Pacific is important, you know, Cinema Pacific, I should say, has been a film festival, but it's been more than that. We are a media arts center. We do year-round programming. We do the Schnitzer Cinema at the Schnitzer Museum monthly, where we show alternative non-mainstream films. We do a gallery exhibition at the Schnitzer Museum. We run a website and devoted to a pioneering independent filmmaker from Oregon, James Blue, whose archive is at the University of Oregon, and we are studying and promoting his work as a model for others. There's been a film festival that we have been doing for the past 6 years on Pacific Rim Cinema, although that festival is going on hiatus next spring while I program the Ashland Independent Film Festival. But Cinema Pacific, as a year-round organization, is going to continue presenting works in Eugene.
Next. Sure. Okay. Do you want to pick up after that, talking about the Bijou? Do you want me to jump
sure.
in? Okay.
Hi, I'm Edward Schissel, owner, operator, and film programmer for the Bijou Art Cinemas and Bijou Metro for the last 5 years. I'm going to talk a little bit today about some of the major issues in the industry that independent cinemas have been struggling with over the past decade. I'll start 2 years ago when the Bijou ran a successful Kickstarter campaign to raise the funds necessary to complete the conversion from 35mm film to digital cinema projection. I won't go too far down the rabbit hole of the digital conversion, but this was an industry-wide mandate motivated primarily by fear of piracy, as well as the unsustainable practice of distributing features on 35mm film. The largest distributors and the largest exhibitors, chains like Regal Cinemas, Cinemark, AMC, decided on a set of standards for presentation and encryption and then imposed deadlines for a total conversion of all theaters nationwide. The distributors essentially externalized the cost of the new technology, which is between $40,000 and $100,000 per screen, which is a totally unattainable sum for a lot of small businesses. The Bijou was able to secure financing for two projectors and funded the third via Kickstarter, which is a platform where a lot of other theaters were successful as well. Meanwhile, the distributors and integrators set up kickback deals with the largest exhibitors, which essentially reimbursed the biggest players for their conversion costs. So while the small independent theaters were scrambling to fundraise within their communities, the largest theater chains basically had their equipment paid for. As a result of this digital cinema initiative, we lost almost 1,000 independent theaters nationwide. During our Kickstarter campaign, we received a number of suggestions from our supporters on how we could run a more profitable operation. One Facebook follower wrote something to the effect of, "If you guys would just stop being so pretentious and play a big movie like The Dark Knight or Skyfall, you'd do a lot better." And that's actually a pretty reasonable suggestion. To be honest, if I had my way, I absolutely would do that. One or two blockbusters, The Hunger Games or The Avengers, would prop up our operation for the entire year, and we could bring the best quality foreign and independent film in for the rest of the year without ever needing to worry about profitability. But the fact of the matter is, we don't exactly get to choose which movies we play, and in a weird way, Regal Cinemas kind of chooses them for us. Our industry operates with an unusual component, which is referred to as clearances. Basically, the very large theater chains choose the movies that they want to show and then mandate exclusivity in their area. In larger, denser markets, this exclusivity may reach a mile or two, but in a market our size, this means the entire city. The practical purpose of this idea is to limit the dilution of the audience for a particular film, but in reality, the chains are able to leverage their buying power and monopolize lucrative titles. What this means specifically for the Bijou is that Regal will choose the movies they think will be the most profitable, and we can have whatever's left over. Traditionally, the 8 Regal Cinemas screens in Eugene were filled with standard mainstream fare, and their programming didn't interfere with the Bijou's much. But since their expansion to 15 screens inside the Valley River Mall, they've begun swallowing up a lot of the biggest independent releases as well. This has been really difficult for us. Not only are we unable to pick up the occasional mainstream title, but we've also begun to lose access to the types of larger independent releases that we've traditionally relied upon for our bigger summer and holiday grosses. On the flip side of this blockbuster dilemma, however, there was a glimmer of hope this past winter that there may be some rewards for the rest of us without those big lucrative titles. We were very pleased this winter to discover that nearly every film nominated in a major category at the Academy Awards played at the Bijou. And there have been some claims, as Randy mentioned, that the Academy has lost touch with moviegoers, but I would contend that this shift is a byproduct of a bigger trend in the nature of moviegoing. Hollywood has increasingly focused its energy on selling the biggest spectacle possible. Juggernaut franchises opening on several screens per location with upcharges for IMAX and 3D contribute to the highest opening weekend grosses possible. But this also keeps Regal Cinemas busy enough to ensure that at least some of the critically acclaimed Oscar-worthy films slip through the cracks and land on the Bijou screens. We were very lucky that Regal's film buyers passed on future Oscar contenders in favor of bigger, flashier titles, and I can only hope that's a trend that continues this year. Looking back at box office grosses from the last three decades, you can see that in the 1980s, the highest grossing films were often the same films that won at the Academy Awards. In recent years, however, the top 10 reads more like a list of popular franchises, remakes, toys, cartoons, and other highly marketable brand names. While it doesn't say much for the taste of the average moviegoer, the strategy has been lucrative for Hollywood and the multiplexes, to say the least. It's worth noting that 3 of the 6 highest grossing films of all time have been released since April. Now, I say that again. 3 of the 6 highest grossing films of all time have been released since this April. The amount of real estate that these kind of releases take up on the multiplex's screens is enormous, and the spillover product ends up playing at independent theaters. So it's not that the Academy has lost touch with mainstream moviegoers, it's that the mainstream fare has begun to edge many of the Oscar contenders back into the art houses, which is where they belong in the first place. The biggest factor, however, contributing to the downward trend in attendance has simply been accessibility. A lot of people blame Netflix and Redbox, but the downturn really began years before that with the widespread adoption of the DVD. Following closely behind that was the collapse of the theatrical window, which is the amount of time between the theatrical release and the home video release. In the days of VHS, this was oftentimes a year or more, and now it's typically 90 days or less, with a lot of titles released online before the theatrical release. It's too easy now to skip the theaters, wait a few weeks, and rent the DVD for a fraction of the price of a ticket. Audiences simply don't need us to curate movies for them anymore. The positive side of this is that audiences have more choices and probably see more films as a whole, just not in the movie theaters. And while we still see regular attendance from baby boomers and teenagers, or teenagers are always going to need an excuse to get out of the house, this leaves us with the million-dollar question of what do we, as small independent cinemas, have to offer everyone in between that they don't already have at home? Beer, air conditioning, luxury seating. The multiplex is selling you spectacle, a 30-foot dinosaur in 3D. But what the independent cinema has to offer is a little more intangible and a lot harder to market. Finding a way to be a profitable local business and roll with the punches in a tumultuous industry dominated by giants has been an enormous challenge. But the Bijou has carved out its niche over the last three decades, and we do our best to continue to evolve and grow, while taking care to preserve our identity and our place in this community. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Joshua Purvis, founder and executive director of the Eugene Film Society. First, I want to recognize both Richard and Edward for their roles in supporting and maintaining both independent and locally produced film, and for exhibiting specialized programming. Were it not for these pre-existing institutions, there would be no need for the Eugene Film Society. The Eugene Film Society is a community arts organization that supports regional film production and a grassroots film culture by encouraging competition and collaboration among community film organizations, promoting seasonal cinematic events like Cinema Pacific, improving visual literacy among our youth, and fostering innovation and investment in the local visual media industry. EFS organizes multiple signature events, including TAD Talks, the Screening and Social, the 72-hour music video competition, the 72-hour horror film competition, and All Hallows Eugene, a downtown Halloween event. We also partner with Cultural Services City of Eugene to screen films on Kesey Square during the summer. The rest of my presentation I sort of want to frame within the context of a TAD Talk that I'll be presenting along with many others at our upcoming event on August 11th at Hi-Fi Music Hall. TAD Talks are an ongoing social event series examining how technology and the arts encourage economic development and community engagement in the downtown Eugene area. In addition to showcasing local artistic talent, the event will host a speaker series during which downtown stakeholders from the tech, arts, and business communities will provide a short 3 to 5 minute presentation, all focused on a particular theme. The theme of the first TAD Talk on August 11th at Hi-Fi Music Hall is Downtown Eugene, a Hub for Millennials, How Valuing Technology, Community, and Creativity Inform New Ideas of Work and Play. So why talk about technology and the arts downtown, particularly in relationship to a film community, and why in regards to millennials? I'll answer that by sharing a brief history of the Eugene Film Society's genesis, the 72-hour horror film competition. In the fall of 2011, I attended the Transit Conference organized by Lane Community College Media Arts. In his talk, Formula for Success, the independent film producer, Jeffrey Cooper of Cut Entertainment Group mentioned that of all film genres, horror was by far the most likely to yield a return on independently produced projects. As example, Mr. Cooper shared that Paranormal Activity, the 2007 found footage supernatural horror film, which cost about $15,000 to produce, went on to gross nearly $200 million in box office sales. Compare those numbers to the highest-grossing film of all time, Avatar, which cost $237 million to make, but grossed nearly $2.8 billion. Paranormal Activity saw a return on investment of over 13,000%, while Avatar saw a return around 11%. Now, granted, who wouldn't mind an extra $3 billion? But who among us has access to A-list actors, billionaire film financiers, or marketing budgets that undergird the Hollywood blockbuster machine? Coming out of that conference, two ideas came to mind. What if there were citizens in this community who would help finance an innovative, low-budget horror film like Paranormal Activity, or Evil Dead, or the Texas Chainsaw Massacre? If there was a grassroots film culture supportive of such capable filmmakers. And rather than relying on an infrastructure we don't currently have, with large production and post-production facilities, a network of millionaire and billionaire supporters, and an endless supply of celebrities, what if that film community cultivated the resources we do have? A population known for valuing creativity and collaboration, as well as two accessible institutions of higher education with developed media arts programs at Lane Community College and the University of Oregon. So in the fall of 2013, I organized the first 72-hour horror film competition. Over 20 teams registered that first year, representing dozens of filmmakers, crew, and talent, many of them students from UO and LCC. Feedback was so overwhelmingly positive from participants and supporters, the Ed Chisel of the Bijou Cinemas and I felt compelled to develop an organization specifically focused on supporting local film production and a grassroots film culture, Eugene Film Society. For our second annual 72-hour horror film competition, the Eugene Film Society partnered with Cultural Services City of Eugene and the Downtown Eugene Merchants to create the All Hallows Eugene Downtown Halloween event that attracted thousands of youth, parents, and young adults to the downtown area. The event displayed not only downtown's recent revitalization, but also its potential as a hub for millennial activity. The vast majority of the 30-plus teams that registered for last year's competition were under the age of 25. Artists chosen to present wood carvings, illustrations, and installation art were all recent graduates of LCC. Local breweries, Sam Bonds and Planktown, sponsored festivities particularly appealing to millennials, and the Bijou Cinema sold out late-night screenings of The Exorcist and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. This year, the Eugene Film Society is very proud to organize the 2015 All Hallows Eugene Downtown Halloween event and the 72-hour horror film competition with support from Nikasi Brewing, Red Wagon Creamery, and LCC Media Arts. We're also partnering with LCC Continuing Education to provide a short screenwriting workshop led by Albert Krim, graduate of the American Film Institute. Mr. Krim will review previous competition submissions and provide a framework for crafting effective 2 to 3 minute short horror films. This collaboration hopes to raise the quality of competition films generally by providing tangible support to budding filmmakers who can then access and apply that knowledge readily during the 72-hour process. In the long term, my hope is that this seed could eventually sprout into ongoing screenwriting offerings at Lane Community College so that their media arts graduates can enter the workforce not only as capable technicians, but competent storytellers. Although the Eugene Film Society organizes other signature events that advance our mission of promoting seasonal cinematic events and encouraging competition and collaboration among community film organizations, such as the Screening and Social that celebrates the best of local film production and specialized exhibition like Cinema Pacific, and the 72-hour music video competition that partners local filmmakers with notable music talent, including our music guest for the event, Matthew Edward and KI Design, the All Hallows Eugene All Hallows Eugene event and the 72-hour horror film competition best exemplify how the Eugene Film Society's mission aligns with the various downtown partners we have, like the Technology Association of Oregon and Lane Workforce Partnership, by rewarding innovation and investment in young artists and technicians who are educated, multicultural, and hungry to engage in a workforce that values technology, creativity, and community. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you to our guests. Today's topic is forecasting the future of independent film. Our speakers are Richard Hershowitz, Joshua Purvis, and Edward Schigel. Thank you. We'll break for a few minutes now and return with members' questions.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Okay, welcome back to the July 31st City Club program forecasting the future of independent film. Our guest speakers are Richard Hershowitz, Joshua Purvis, and Edward Schigel. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each.
Okay, I'm John Attic, a City Club member since 2003, and I see a lot of movies. Question from our table, representing the views of consensus group. Do you folks think that showing films in Kesey Square will be able to revitalize that particular space and area?
Should I speak to that? Well, here's the deal, right, with Kesey Square. So when we showed King Kong last year in the summertime, we had hundreds of people show up. And it was a magnificent event that had this strong community feel. That only happens occasionally. And so could a consistent film screening series do that in a short run, right? So this year we're doing three film screenings. August 19th, we're doing Raiders of the Lost Ark, the first entry in the Indiana Jones series. August 26th, we're doing E.T., the Extraterrestrial. And then September 2nd, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We've got great partners for the event, including Nikasi Brewing, Bijou, Red Wagon, and I know I'm forgetting one, so sponsor, I'll get back to you just a bit. So that opportunity is, we're hoping, going to bring hundreds of people to the downtown area, and that's what we're doing with support from the Cultural Services City of Eugene. So we've got the city behind it, Eugene Film Society's behind it, we've got businesses supporting it. And so, yes, on those nights, there will be activity on Kesey Square. That space will be activated, and there will be a community feel. And I hope you all will come check that out and embrace all the energy happening downtown. But that's only a part of a larger picture of activating that space. And so for that to be continually activated, we need a lot more support from the arts and the tech community and from businesses to be involved in that.
I have a little bit to add to that. Edward Chisel, Bijou Cinemas. Even though the Bijou is not doesn't stand to gain anything financially from the free screenings in the square, it's really important to us to remind people that watching a movie with a large audience and experiencing that kind of group engagement, particularly for comedy, horror, action, is a really important and really special experience that I think people are missing out on when they consume most of their movies via Netflix or on their iPhone or whatever they do these days. And we just want to make sure that people remember that that's the way movies are meant to be seen.
I'm Jane Smith, City Club member. My question may be oxymoronic, given the nature of independent filmmakers, but I'll ask it anyway. Northern countries in Europe appear to support independent film and produce some excellent theater. Do you imagine in the future grant-making streams from government like NEA and NEH might support independent filmmakers, or have they?
I spent many years on panels for this is Richard Hurst speaking, for the NEA and New York State Council of the Arts and others, and public funding is an extremely important thing. You know, I was part of a peer review panel where we would judge the works, other filmmakers, other film curators like myself. It was a terrific process, and that funding, for example, I mentioned Spike Lee before. His initial films, Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, She's Gotta Have It, received funding through the New York State Council of the Arts, public funding. Otherwise, they would not have happened. So again, this idea of independent film as a laboratory that ultimately benefits the broader commercial filmmaking as well, because it advances filmmaking in this country, it's vital. Public funding was extremely important for that. You know, in Europe, in many European countries, there is a tax on, let's say, television sets and entertainment equipment that then gets applied to, again, advancing film, supporting independent, non-commercial film. We don't have that here. I would love to see that come back, and that's part of a larger necessity of believing in what public we can do collectively through you know, through collective participation, democratic institutions, government, et cetera.
Hi, I'm Marlene Nesri from, been a member for, I don't know, 10 or 12 years. And thank you all for bringing this overview of the local scene. It's really informative and interesting, especially kind of the economics, which always interests me. The other thing that always interests me is finding out where the women are in this religion. And so I'm going to ask you guys, where are females, where are people of color within your governing structures and your programming structures and your management structures?
Edward Chisel, Bijou Cinemas. I am the only male owner of the Bijou. There are three women that are my partners, and our film buyer is actually a woman as well.
Cine Pacific has had a staff of three, that is a professional staff of three. Larissa Ennis and Patty Jo Angelini are of a different gender than myself.
And then for the Eugene Film Society, we have two women on our board of directors, Kate Sullivan, an instructor with LCC, and then Evangeline LaRoque, a local filmmaker. Any of our film events, we always have female filmmakers, talent, crew participating in the process. I know our winner from the 72-hour music video competition, the Mark Gall Award winner, was a female student at UO Cinema Studies. At our screening and social, we had women represented as filmmakers and as programmers as well. Across the table, we have representation in the film community here.
I'm Robin Fletcher, a member since 2004. And my table was interested in knowing more of the details about the 72-hour film project. How does that work? Can you talk about that?
We have two different, we have several ones. Adrenaline Film Project started with Cinema Pacific 6 years ago. And actually, I brought it here from Virginia, where I founded Adrenaline with Jeff Wadlow, a filmmaker based in Los Angeles who grew up in Virginia. Anyway, there are 48 72-hour projects all over the country, and generally the way they work is that they give filmmakers come in and they're given a line of dialogue, a prop, sometimes a genre. They're told at the very beginning of the project, and then they have to bring in their film 48 or 72 hours later, complete. They can't by being told that kickoff information, that they can't really begin before the process starts. Anyway, what made the Adrenaline Film Project different is that it's an entirely mentored process. We bring in professional filmmakers who actually have to approve the pitch by the 12 teams of filmmakers. They then have to approve the script and greenlight it before they go out shooting. They visit the set. They look at the cuts. So it's actually a much more of an educational program, an intensive workshop, really, in which filmmakers get training. Joshua, you want to talk about your project?
Sure. No, I just want to echo what Richard said about the Adrenaline Film Project. It's a wonderful education opportunity for the reasons Richard provided. In contrast, the 72-hour horror film competition really is about generating material, supporting collaboration that is ongoing. So at each of our horror film competitions begins with a meet-and-greet kickoff where we provide the line of dialogue and the mandated prop, as Richard mentioned earlier. And then we provide all bunch of actors and talent and supporters to be in that room. And so these relationships that begin there not only are sort of developed during the 72-hour process, but continue beyond that. With the music video competition, it really was about supporting the Eugene Weekly's Next Big Thing music contest. So it ran in alignment with that, but also it was about making connections and collaborations. So we screened music videos of hit singles by local musicians, and then many of those filmmakers and musicians have continued to collaborate. Even most recently, I think a Saturday before last, at the Bijou Metro, we had a rental with a filmmaker and a hip-hop artist who met at the meet-and-greet for the 72-hour music video competition. They had worked with different partners but had met at the meet and greet, and then from there developed a relationship and have gone on to produce music videos. And that has been a common consequence of that process, is we have multiple musicians and filmmakers who have continued to collaborate. So in contrast, again, to the education experience adrenaline provides, EFS 72-hour competitions are about generating material and supporting collaboration.
John Dolo, City Club member, and I have mucho many questions, but why don't we start with a little background. The independent film industry moved out of Hollywood about how long ago? Can you give us some reasons why? What the future is going to be around here? I know they make some up in Vancouver, and now they're doing some in Portland. What about Eugene in that area? Let's start with that.
I'm sorry. So the independent film movement in general coming out of Hollywood?
Yeah.
Well, I'll start. I wouldn't say it came out of Hollywood. It came it came about as an alternative to Hollywood. You know, it's kind of interesting. The person who's considered the real pioneer of the American independent feature movement is John Cassavetes. John Cassavetes was a Hollywood actor, but he was troubled by the kind of scripts that he was being made to play, and he used the money he had, he was making in Hollywood, he made a 16-millimeter low-budget independent feature called Shadows in New York that ended up inspiring people for decades and say, wow, I could make a feature film too on very little money and it could be really engaging and can get into theaters. It's interesting that that happens again with Robert Redford, same situation, a commercial popular actor, again, troubled by the lousy films he's getting to make and being given by the mainstream, and he seeds Sundance, which is much more than a film festival. It's all kinds of workshops and programs to support the emergence of independent filmmakers. So, yeah, so there is a relationship to Hollywood, but I guess, cause I hadn't really thought about that until you asked the question, but it's really been establishing a whole separate ecosystem. Sundance has been vital for that. As far as Eugene goes, and I'm going to defer, let's say, to Joshua and Edward, maybe.
Joshua Purvis, Eugene Film Society. And talk in terms of the local scene, really where the Eugene Film Society sees an opportunity to support that is by tying in to partners in the technology, in the video game design, and larger creative enterprise generally. Because one of the realities of independent film production in Eugene, with a couple, one, we're not necessarily sunny, like Ashland or Bend, and we're not urban like Portland, and we don't have a strong active workforce in media, meaning actively working. So often when we have local productions, they often outsource labor to, well, from LA or from Portland or elsewhere, because in those communities, filmmakers can maintain an active portfolio. They're actively working, they're getting jobs to meet deadlines. Not many filmmakers here can say the same thing, but we do have a resident video game community. We also have education, a media institution, IRS Educational Media. So we do have pockets and organizations to provide opportunities for an active workforce. And we see that, right? I see some of the best graduates coming out of LCC Media Arts going and working at IRS Educational Media. But you know, how long are they there for? Maybe not long, because if they're ambitious, they probably are going to try to move on to Portland or LA or somewhere else, because there's not a variety of opportunities we could provide those filmmakers yet. But, you know, talking with someone like Ted Brown with BitForce, the video game community here, you know, there's a commonality in what we see in the benefits of something like the municipal broadband that's been introduced to the Broadway Commerce Center, the U.S. Bank, and the Woolworth Building. And working with Matt Sayer from TAO, Technology Association Oregon, you know, EFS and TAO are very much about supporting the expansion of their broadband throughout the downtown area because of how that can support more media activity in the area because of the availability of that network and the incentive to businesses, whether from out of the area coming and setting up shop here, or startups because of access to that network and proximity to other creative entrepreneurs.
And Ed, you mentioned that a lot of theaters have to go over to digital now. Has that disrupted the independent film much, or do they have to buy their own equipment, and how is the cost of that?
No, I think the
The digital conversion on the exhibition side probably has had very little effect, other than that, I mean, it's expensive to produce the digital cinema package that they need for us, but it was probably just as expensive to produce a 35 millimeter film, or certainly a lot more expensive in many cases. On the exhibition side, I guess what happens for us at least is, I mean, I see at Sundance all these independent films, the successful ones get sucked up by satellites of the major distributors like Fox Searchlight, which is obviously a part of 20th Century Fox, Focus Features, which is a part of Universal, and they distribute those films to the smaller independent theaters like us in a lot of cases. And they do a really good job of monopolizing our screens and saying, hey, you got to play these less popular ones if you want the big ones from us, which makes it really difficult for us to make room to play the truly independent films that don't have a lot of advertising dollars behind them. We get emails all the time from producers and directors that are directly trying to say, hey, can you play my movie there? And I almost always have to say, I don't have room to do it. It's hard for them to guarantee any kind of an audience. And so those films tend to get either a very, very limited theatrical release. In some cases, they're able to do a real good grassroots effort, rent the space from us, and get an okay turnout. And but by and large, I think that the video on demand and direct DVD is where most of those truly independent films find their audience. And that's what I was talking about, accessibility. It's good for those small filmmakers because they can really get that stuff out there a lot cheaper than they could before.
Hi, Mary Layton, City Club member since 2006. I have a question from one of the guests at our table who wants to know, what's the future for independent feature-length films in Eugene beyond the horror genre? And you did address this a little bit, but I'm also interested from an economic development point of view. I mean, is there any, what would we need to do to make it work as a economically viable, artistically viable real work here, not just 72 hours of blood and guts?
No doubt. Joshua Purvis, Eugene Film Society. We do have examples here in the Eugene-Springfield area of media production, like the Division Productions there in Springfield produce Graveyard Cars, which I believe is on Discovery. And so I think one idea is sort of to expand the concept of film into media generally and understand that storytelling, time-based video audio storytelling can encompass multiple forms, right? Whether it's video games, whether it's television. And so thinking about it in that way and trying to be inventive and innovative, I should say, with how we're trying to employ and get people jobs and access to a network that can then inspire them and kind of highlight sort of contemporary taste and forms, and so to create that sense of engagement to figure out what venue or what forms will work for our audience in terms of producers, right? And I'll leave it at that. Ed, do you want to jump in on any of that? Okay. That's good.
Clay Stevens, City Club member since 2013. My question was kind of on something no one touched on, and that's the movie rating system. It's this very closed, non-transparent system by the MPAA. To my understanding, by a dozen housewives or something here, that doesn't really represent the wider community, and it really imposes a lot of censorship on particularly independent films who don't have really negotiating power of anything behind that. And an NC-17 rating is often a kiss of death for anything. And instead of asking you how do you feel about the rating system, because I'm going to go out on a limb and guess you're not very happy with it, my question is, what would you propose as an alternative system instead of this, closed, few people get to decide on this? Thanks.
Wow. I will say that I don't really care what the MPAA says in their ratings, and we generally will let customers of any age come into our films as long as it's not an extremely pornographic or explicit film. I tend to try and steer customers or parents that are curious about the content to a website called Kids in Mind, which rates almost every film that comes out for profanity and nudity and various other types of content that might be offensive, and it details each instance with a detailed description of the scene and exactly what is said or shown. And I think that's a really good way for people that are concerned about what their kids may be exposed to or what they may be exposed to when they go to the movies. And I think that kind of specificity is important because everyone sort of has a sliding scale of what they can tolerate.
Raisa Maddox, City Club member since 2014, representing Capella Market. I'm wondering how greater access to technology has changed the quality of independent films.
Yeah, can I start by just saying, I mean, digital video has just been a godsend, I think, for independent features. Accessibility of low budget. I mean, look, there's a film, maybe the best, one of the best independent features of the year is Tangerine by Sean Baker, which was shot on an iPhone 5S, not even an iPhone 6. And it looks incredible. I mean, it's beautiful to watch. I was stunned when I saw it. The fact that a feature film can be projected on a big screen and be made with affordable equipment, this, in my lifetime, I never imagined. I always felt that film should be like writing. You pick up a pen and you can write a book. Film was never like that. The cost of entry was so high. That really changed with DV, digital video. Anybody want to add anything?
Dan Bryant, City Club member since 1996. I have a daughter who works in the industry as an assistant camera operator, and so I've been privileged to be on a couple of sets and watch productions, and have been very impressed with the level of professionalism in those, and particularly in a role that I never thought, never occurred to me is necessary, and that is the safety coordinator. And I bring this up because we don't think of film as being a dangerous industry, but there was a young woman killed last year, actually in the same job as my daughter, working on a train trestle.
Right.
Someone failed. And I'm thinking in independent film in particular, where you're trying to be edgy, you're trying to do daring, you know, kinds of things. So I'm wondering what thoughts you have in what things are done in the industry to protect, workers who may not always be aware of the dangers, and they're trying to make a living, and they're trying to impress somebody, and they're, you know, going out on a limb. Is that an issue that you deal with?
Do you have anything, John?
Joshua Purvis, Eugene Film Society. All I can really say, because I don't oversee a lot of productions in the area, you know, I mostly work in the area promoting and kind of supporting. I will say, you know, the process Eugene Film Society has, the 72-hour competition or even the adrenaline, there's awareness of the need for safety precautions, so we certainly stress that. Because it's a creative endeavor, ultimately we can't take responsibility for what filmmakers and the relationship they have with their talent or crew, whatever they maintain. I will say, I'm sure, you know, for productions like Graveyard Cars or anything that has a larger syndication, most likely those crew or talent or union or have some representation that sort of, you know, ensures or kind of monitors for this sort of safety precautions. But other than that, I couldn't really say anything specific to the issue.
Randy Prince back up here again. And Joshua, in preparing for this program, you told me something that I thought was really interesting about how the television show Portlandia had really helped bring together a community of professionals up in our neighbor to the north in Portland, made it possible to make more films, and that also some of these shows were a place where storytelling was really central compared to the multiplex, where the big dinosaur, the spectacular car chase, and all those things were the reason you went and paid your money. Well, they're television shows. I mean, what size of an audience can you get for that? And Edward, you mentioned, you know, your thoughts about how wonderful it is for a bunch of people to get together and see a film together and go through the story experience together. So I'm kind of maybe asking Richard first, how do you feel about this? Do you think we're sort of the experience of sharing a story and an audience, are we losing that in the big crowd? Do you have any regrets that maybe television is where we go through that?
No, I have a very expansive view of the independent feature movement, that an independent media movement that includes the exciting things going on television right now. I think it's thanks to the independent media movement. You know, if you look at who the writers are, the directors, because of the kind of the starving of art house theaters and independent distributors, you'll notice that some of these great writers and some of these great directors were nurtured by Sundance, that they made independent features years ago. They've been able to get employed by Showtime, by HBO, by IFC. The Independent Film Channel is the name of the organization that creates Portlandia, the Independent Film Channel. So it's really part of the larger independent media movement, a lot of the television that you're talking about that we're very excited about these days. I don't see it as competitive.
Joel Korn, City Club member since 2012. This question is addressed to Ed. The first thing I'd like to do is thank you for opening Bijou Metro and allowing us to have now six different films each week instead of two or three. There was a lot of talk about collaboration. I'd like you to discuss with the audience the collaboration you have with other downtown businesses as part of the membership in Bijou.
Okay. I'm actually going to throw that over to Joshua, who handles most of our promotional relationships with the businesses downtown. He's built a lot of what we do with other businesses and built out a lot of what we do with our membership program in general.
Joshua Purvis, now speaking, I guess, as manager of events and promotions for the Bijou. We have had resounding just open arms from the downtown community. I could go into a listing of all the different businesses we partner with. Just to name just a few: Sizzle Pie, The Barn Light, Red Wagon Creamery, Party Downtown, and on and on and on. The idea really is how to generate an excitement in an area. And so kind of going off what Ed was saying about the film viewing experience, it's sort of morphed into an event, right? It's not just kind of the viewing of the individual piece of cinema, but it's about the dinner before or after, the coffee, the discussion, what you can kind of bring into the theater, and then how you leave from the theater and go out into the community. So just for example, we did a series of the residents of Gen X in partnership with the Barn Light, with Blunt Graphics, and with Party Downtown, where we showed a series of films that all had a standout soundtrack with a lot of music from the 70s and 80s. We had Stop Making Sense, the Jonathan Demme documentary of the Talking Heads. We had High Fidelity. We had Dazed and Confused, a Richard Linklater film. And on that, we did Sunday matinee screenings. And then the audience would go over to Party Downtown, and they had a nice little setup for us. They prepared us breakfast or brunch, I should say, had coffee. And we just had a conversation about the film, about the music, about a number of the people in the audience had sort of, you know, been alive and been hip and active during that period and could talk about the youth perspective from the 70s and 80s. And there were people who were younger and sort of approached these films from home video, you know, or because of what we offer, the ability to see those films in a cinema. But what was really neat about that and what made it such a unique experience was the community aspect, right? Not only for us at the Bijou to be able to partner with all these great businesses, but to be able to bring our viewership out into the community and engage in conversation and discourse about the films in an environment that's hip, is exciting, has great food, great coffee, et cetera, right? So we just continue to be able to have that kind of support and partnership with all these great downtown businesses and play a part in downtown revitalization.
Okay. Thank you, Richard Hershowitz, Joshua Purvis, and Edward Schizel, for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program, forecasting the future of independent film. Let's give them a round of applause. And thanks again to our sponsors, Oregon Country Fair, Eugene Legal, and KRVM. We take a break in our programming and we'll meet again after Labor Day on September 11th for our first program in the 2015-2016 programming year at the Downtown Athletic Club. For more information about coming programs, please visit our website. Thank you again.